everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking with a material scientist. You'll find out what that's all about in a few minutes. His name is Fred Woodle. He's from the University of California at Santa Barbara, and it's going to be a very entertaining 30 minutes, I guarantee it. Fred Woodle, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
Now, tell us, before we get into material science, and I know that you're into photovoltaics, et cetera, efficient use of solar energy for society, tell us, how did you become a scientist? What were those formative years and decision makings?
Well, I was born and raised in a small village in Bolivia known as Cochabamba. And, well, in those days, it was the second largest city. Now it's just a little village. Anyway, over there, you could learn or do anything you wanted to. So, for example, one day I had an idea. Well, I asked my father, how do electric motors work? And I was about 10 years old, something like that. And he said, well, you know, electricity goes through the wires, and then when it goes in a bobbin, then it creates a magnetic field, and then you you can modulate the magnetic field. You can have this piece of iron that can go through the gets attracted or repelled, and you can get motion that way, and that's an electric motor. And I said, well, that's interesting. So I started thinking some more, and I'd already learned a little bit about how steam engines work. And so I thought, well, maybe I could make the equivalent of steam engine with an electric motor, that is, have a reciprocating electric motor. And so I made
10 years old, 11 years old.
Yeah, I made my bobbin, and and I took a nail, and it went back and forth between the bobbins. Wow, you know, I invented
them.
Well, it turned out, you know, this was done in the 19th century sometime before. But that was probably my first dabbling with electricity, and it stuck with me forever. To this day, I'm absolutely fascinated by magnetism and electricity and in the interplay.
Did your parents, your father, was he in
my father was a textile business? My father was a textile engineer.
Okay.
So the only reason we ended up in Bolivia is because we're Jewish and had to escape Hitler. So
right.
And they escaped Hitler at the very last minute. They did exactly what the Trapp family did. They went over.
When in fact did your father and mother leave?
1939.
Oh, okay. So right.
Yeah, after the Anschluss. So they literally escaped over the Alps into Italy, from there into Switzerland, from there to Italy, and caught a boat and went to Chile, caught a train, a British train, to Bolivia. Yeah,
talking about British trains, I remember when I think Mitterrand had to go and visit Margaret Thatcher in London, and he made the comment how nice it was that his journey, that first 2 hours in France, flew by, but it was nice to just meander through the English countryside on the train. It's a very interesting comment. So then you obviously left Bolivia when you were quite young, eh?
Yeah, well, what happened was we had Bolivia was in a feudal system until 1952. So if you owned land with native workers on the land, they were considered serfs, literally. And you could buy and trade land with the you bought the people with the land.
Right. Okay. I mean, do they use the word serf as opposed to slave? Sounds more respectable somehow.
And not funny. Anyway, so in the 1952 revolution, the rebels that took over the country, they decided they're going to nationalize everything. So they nationalized the mines and they nationalized the farms. And so they gave the farmers back to the people who worked the land. And the people reverted 500 years to pre-Columbian times, when they would produce only enough for themselves, a little bit for the Inca, and the rest to barter with their neighbors.
All right.
And the cities were starving. It was an absolute economic disaster. The price of a boliviano, the national coin, went from something like 150 to 200 bolivianos to a dollar to 13,000 bolivianos to a dollar in a month.
Wow.
So,
I mean, that's reminiscent of what happened in the pre-war Germany.
So my father was painfully familiar with hyperinflation. So whenever any foreigner came into this little town, he would grab them and get dollars. He would change bolivianos for dollars. And as soon as he had any dollars, he would send them to the States, to friends that we had here. So we were, at least he was anchoring whatever money we had. And so, and we applied to come to this country in 1952. Now, in the middle 1900s, there were quotas to come to the United States. And the worst quota was the Polish quota. Between the time that you applied and the time you were actually allowed to get into the States was 8 years. The next worst was the Austrian quota. And my parents never naturalized in Bolivia, so we were all on the Austrian passport. So we had to wait 6 years. So in 1958, in 52 we applied, and in 58 we came
to
the country.
So in those days, it wasn't a matter of the occupation.
No.
It was just a matter of the nationality.
Yeah.
I remember right. when I came. So I thought I'd come as a scientist from England.
Right, yeah.
But they said, oh, don't worry. The scientist list is 20 years. You can come as a skilled artisan. So that's what I am by definition. I'm not sure what it means, but I am by definition in America a skilled artisan. I'm very proud of it.
Yeah, well, anyway, so came to the country, and at that point I had not quite finished high school. So I finished high school in Los Angeles, and then I didn't have enough credits to go straight to university. So I went to junior college for 2 years and then transferred to UCLA and got a degree in chemistry. Originally, I was going to be a pre-med,
right.
But I, even though I did like biology and I have a pretty good memory, so I probably would have made a reasonable MD, but I was still so fascinated with science that as soon as I took organic chemistry...
You were hooked.
I was hooked.
So where did you go to graduate school?
Also UCLA, actually, right. Yeah. UCLA would let something like 2 or 3 a year sneak through, allow him to stay instead of...
And there you were.
Yeah, now it's, yeah.
So tell us about your career. I mean, after a PhD, you worked in industry for quite a little.
Actually, after a PhD, I went and... So I got my PhD with Professor Donald Cram at UCLA, and then I went to work with Woodward at Harvard.
All right, 2 Nobel laureates.
Right. So I sure chose them, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Actually, I guess if there ever were to be an epitaph of my life, it's literally been serendipity after serendipity. Is it everything? Yeah. You know, everything was serendipitous, right? Especially, you know, I go to UCLA, and I'm taking undergraduate courses in general, and I'm standing in one of the hallways comparing my homework results to what was on the board, and one of the classmates walks up, and he says, I'm in our organic class. I say, yeah. And he said, well, you know, I made an appointment with a guy who wrote our book. I said, you did? So yes, you know, I'm a serious pre-med, and I want to get an A in a typical pre-med. I'm going to get an A in this class. So I'm going to go sweet-talk this guy. I said, well, go ahead. And he said, no, I need someone for moral support. Will you come with me? And I said, well, I don't know. He said, come on, it'll be fun. I said, I don't know. So we, sure enough, the day comes, I think it was next day, and it was Cram, who had written the book Cram and Hammond, which was the book that we were using, but he wasn't teaching it. But he was going to teach it the next quarter, the next semester in those days. Anyway, we walk in, and Cram was a pretty good judge of character. And he had this guy pegged in 2 seconds or more, and he literally dismissed him. You know, he just said, thank you very much. It was nice meeting you.
Bye-bye.
Talk to my secretary. And that was it. And so then he says, so why are you here? I said, well, I don't know. I like your book. It's pretty good. What chapter are you in? Was this chapter. What do you think of the book? Well, you know, I would have put this reaction over here. I wouldn't have called it this. I would have called it redox instead of whatever you call it. And he says, are you sure? I said, yeah, so let me see. He looks in his book and says, you know, yeah, it could be under redux, right? And he said, okay, now, I have this visiting scientist from Western New York. Why don't you go down the hall over here, third door to the right, and introduce yourself, and just tell him that you're going to spend undergraduate research in this laboratory. Just like that.
That was it. That was great.
Just like that.
So, okay. In fact, though, the fellow with the bad character, you know, the one who wanted to schmooze crab, he was really your window for
that
the
That was the serendipity.
If he hadn't said come along, you wouldn't have gone.
Right. And I might be an MD.
Yeah, right. But you're not. Let's jump on to your career.
Okay. No, so, as you may know, organic chemistry, like most fields, has a huge spectrum, right? All the way from biology to engineering. Nowadays, to engineering.
Right.
When I was in graduate school, well, all the way to physical chemistry, let's say, right?
Right.
So you had natural products synthesis, biosynthesis, physical organic chemistry, right? So those were pretty much the branches. So I was a physical organic chemist by training. And Cram's philosophy was always, you don't just synthesize a molecule because it's pretty or because nature produced it and you'd like to check it out. You want that molecule to do something, you know, to teach you something about chemistry or physical chemistry or whatever. And so that was always missing. In fact, as I was approaching the time to finish my thesis, I was thinking that you should be able to do with carbon compounds, with organic molecules, what you normally do with the rest of the periodic table. Because carbon is so versatile that you should be able to conduct electricity. Normally, you know, you have a table like this. You don't want the table to conduct electricity. In fact, they're insulators. Right? So we usually use organic compounds, organic materials, as insulators, not as conductors. And I was going to do the opposite.
All right.
And then I also had an idea that whoever is going to make the most efficient battery is going to be the world at their fingers.
Right.
Right? So to store energy effectively, lightweight, not lead-acid battery,
right,
but something better. And again, organic chemistry should be able to
do that. Still a goal.
And that is still,
still don't have storage.
Absolutely.
Really.
And I work on lithium batteries.
Right.
Off and on, I've worked on batteries,
right,
for quite a while. Not as concentrated as on photovoltaics.
Right.
Or other organic electronics. So I went, I got my degree, went to work with Woodward, and in Woodward's group, I was part of the huge team that synthesized vitamin B12.
All right, famous synthesis. You're one name out of how many?
100 or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. And it turned out to be, in the end, what some people call the Vietnam of synthesis, because there were, if I remember correctly, something like 6 or 8 asymmetric centers. And a typical Woodwardian approach, he started with one asymmetric center given to him from nature and built the rest of them based on that one.
Right.
Okay. Now, in the meantime, what had happened in the process of the strategy of making this huge macrocycle, one half was done in Switzerland at the ETH by Eschenmoser and the other half by Woodward at Harvard, and came time to connect the two halves. And it was fairly trivial to connect the top of the big macrocycle. But there was trouble at the bottom. Ultimately, by the time they finally got it to make vitamin B12, it was 1 out of 8 isomers, because they racemized several centers. And if HPLC, high-performance liquid chromatography, hadn't been invented, it would have been an absolute failure, because only through HPLC could they see that they actually made it. It was the most minor peak of a whole bunch of peaks.
You're listening to Science Studio. I'm talking to Professor Fred Woodall from the University of California, Santa Barbara. And we're talking about the early stages of his career and his fascination with carbon, and thinks, you know, carbon is but one of 118 elements. But could carbon do what all the other elements can do? Conducting electricity was his goal. Did he manage to achieve that? Wait until the second half. We'll be back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Hepatitis C kills more people in the world than HIV and is the leading cause of liver transplants in the U.S.
But that's about to change dramatically. A new drug may wipe out hepatitis C infections with basically one pill a day for 8 weeks and without severe side effects.
The current treatment is excruciating, where side effects include terrible rashes, depression, and fever. It requires up to 48 weeks of ribavirin and interferon alpha. The interferon is what patients dread.
The new drugs, much like HIV medications, target enzymes the hepatitis C virus requires to reproduce. But unlike HIV, where the virus's genetic information becomes part of someone's genetic makeup, the hepatitis C virus does not do this. So drugs can eliminate it and cure the patient.
One of these new drugs is called sofosbuvir. It inhibits the virus enzyme that copies its genetic information so it can't reproduce.
The drug is not paired with interferon injections for types 2 and 3 hepatitis C. But type 1, which is what most Americans have, requires interferon, although for a much shorter time.
Even better news is another pill called ledipizvir that could eliminate the need for interferon and will soon be available. The public health benefit is tremendous. We'd see fewer liver transplants, liver cancer, and people dying from liver failure.
The downside is the cost, which could reach $100,000 per treatment. Even so, they offer great promise. Since hepatitis C can lay latent for years, a number of baby boomers may be diagnosed in the coming years. So don't wait. Get tested.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell with Fred Woodle, and we're talking about photovoltaics, using carbon-based materials to transform solar energy into electrical energy. So where are we on that stage? What is your current work in this area, Fred?
Well, to make an organic photovoltaic, you need two classes of compounds. You need a compound that will donate electrons, and you need a compound that will accept electrons. And when you irradiate this mixture, let's say, actually it's compound, this material, a photon of light is absorbed, and you create an electron and the absence of an electron that's a hole. And so this electron hole is essentially like a giant atom. They know of each other, and it's called an exciton. And then that exciton has to be separated into an electron and a hole. And once you've done that, you have voltage, right? So that's the photovoltaic process. Well, in order to improve that process, well, first of all, the measure that we have is called the photoconversion efficiency, PCE. And when people first tried to make organic photovoltaics, first of all, they tried to imitate what happens in plants, photosynthesis, and so on, the first step. And they were getting terrible, terrible efficiencies, especially because when you transfer the electron from the donor to the acceptor, it can back transfer, right? And that was the killer. The back charge transfer was as fast as the forward transfer.
Right.
And so the final electron that you could get out was zilch. 0.03%, something like that.
That's zilch.
Well, Mother Nature was extremely kind to us with the discovery of fullerenes. And so fullerenes are electron acceptors. And we already had a family of electron-donating materials, including polymers that were pretty good at donating electrons.
And fullerenes, just for the audience, that's this new form of carbon.
Right.
It's been known forever because it's been in soot forever, but it's C60, buckyballs, you'd call it what you want.
Yeah.
Fullerene because of Buckminster Fuller and his geodesic domes.
Right. It turns out that it was misnomered, but we can that's a different story. So C60 turns out to be a good electron acceptor. So as a result, when you make a composite of these two and you irradiate, you transfer an electron to C60. But the reason C60 is such a good acceptor is because there's tremendous strain, right? The carbon atoms that make up C60 are so-called sp2 hybridized. And in that form, they want to be planar, trigonal. Well, they're in the shape of a sphere, so they're clearly strained. And they relieve that strain by accepting an electron, because when you add an electron, you the ball becomes slightly larger, relieving some of the strain. So it's not going to be very willing to give it back. So right away, when we made first with Dr. Sarit Chifchi, who was a postdoc at the time, the first solar cells of an organic donating polymer in a C60, it was clear that the back electron transfer was 1,000 times slower or right. more than the forward. So that was
and that wasn't something people predicted. I mean, that's one
all.
Of the things you're talking about, serendipity.
Absolutely.
I mean, we do lots and lots of experiments because we have a nose.
Right.
And we're curious. And this is one case where all of a sudden a big discovery is made.
Right. Then you take advantage of your training as a synthetic chemist because C60 is quite insoluble and quite difficult to, we call it in organic synthesis, intractable. So we can't dissolve it. You can't do much. So we modified it slightly. And at the same time, we had another project where a young man called me from the University of San Francisco and he said, I was just doing computer modeling and I found out that C60 is just the right size to fit in the cavity of the protease of HIV. And if we can inhibit the HIV protease, you know, we can cure AIDS or something. So anyway, I sent one of my postdocs, Rin Siebesma, in fact, in the lab, to make a modified C60 that will be water soluble. And so it could be used in biology. And he was working on some aspects of that. And another Dutch postdoc had joined the group, K.S. Hummelin. And Hummelin had made another one of these, much simpler, that was thought should be water-soluble. It was a carboxylic acid, so it should be water-soluble. And it wasn't, but anyway. And then Sarachivsky comes to Hummelin and says, I need a C60 derivative that will blend better with this polymer so I can make a better solar cell. And so Hummelin said, well, I happen to have this thing. That
this
turned
one.
Out to be PCBM, which is right now still the fruit fly of organic photovoltaics.
The fruit fly, for those of you, that's Drosophila. And everybody in molecular biology studies Drosophila, it seems.
Right. It did, anyway.
Did, right, yes.
Yeah, anyway, so...
So where are we then, Fred?
So in those days, the PCE, or power conversion efficiency, was only about maybe 1%, something like that. And then over the years, it developed to 3, and then we were stuck at 3 for a while, then it jumped to 6, and now we are at 11%. The barrier was that engineers gave us was 10%. If you can do 10%, then you can compete with amorphous silicon.
And in lay terms, the efficiency means for every photon that you get in, you get an electron that's mobilized.
You get a voltage,
yeah,
okay,
right.
Which is only 10% or 11%.
Right.
But that's sufficient. And it's particularly sufficient for an organic system because it's flexible. You can make roof tiles out of it. You can do anything
right.
you want. And so that was that's where we are. And people are still pushing. There are some claims of 12%. But chances are that we'll probably – there are theoretical papers out there that say that the maximum you're going to do, if you ever get there, is going to be 15%.
I mean, is there a problem when you talk about using organic photovoltaics? And they've obviously got to be out there in the sun.
Right.
Which means that there's an issue of degradation over time. I mean, that's a big issue, I suppose.
Yeah, but we've learned to use – the proper coatings, encapsulation is obviously a very important
right.
issue here. And there are claims that people have put experimental solar cells on roofs in Connecticut that have suffered a whole year, that is winter and summer, and have degraded to about 80% of their original. So it's
okay.
not bad. Okay, might even be acceptable. It's easily improved. But the way I see it is they don't have to be on roofs of houses. They could be powering your calculator, your computer, your little fan in the office. The office is producing a lot of photons,
yeah, yes.
fluorescent light,
right.
and they're nicely protected in
right.
indoors.
So I mean, that's an interesting... It's
that
obvious,
would be a niche. That would definitely be a niche for us.
Right. Yeah.
There are already very entrepreneurial people in Europe who are making purses for women. And so one side of the purse is an organic photovoltaic, and it's useful to charge their cell phone while they're going someplace. So just to go back, organic materials are clearly different from traditional materials. And one of the biggest difference, of course, is that inorganic materials, or the traditional materials, are so-called extended solids. The whole chunk of the material that you hold in your hand, all the atoms are interconnected.
And right.
It's a giant molecule. It's a
lattice. Right.
Whereas organic solids, 99.999%, are molecular solids, and they're composed of molecules. And the difference in bond lengths and distances between the intramolecular and intermolecular is pretty large.
Yes.
And again, to make an organic material with a particular property, you have to design essentially the molecule in such a way that you also control the way it packs in the solid state. Because
right.
if it packs the wrong way, electrons are gonna bump into other things instead of delocalizing the way you would like them to delocalize.
And that's one of the trade secrets that you've got to overcome.
No, it's not a trade secret. That's one of those things that the years of intuition or whatever, years of background give you a certain intuition that tells you, well, this molecule will very likely pack this way. And then,
right.
Yeah.
So then you've got to a point now, you say, not you personally, but that our society, our science research people, are up to about 10, 11%. And that seems, you know, perhaps at the threshold of utility.
But what happens always is you're working very hard on this, right? And then there's a paradigm shift.
Yeah.
Right? Then somebody else comes along with some other goody. So while for the last decade or so, two decades, the organic photovoltaics or so-called bulk heterojunction solar cells were heavily studied.
Right.
The inorganic guys have come along now, without trying very hard, have gotten 15%.
Yep.
So
this is the so-called perovskite.
Perovskite.
Yes.
Yes. And so quite a few of us who were so enamored with the organic, we're all looking at the perovskites.
And that's actually a lesson in science. I mean, there's two types of scientists. There's the one that's just got a fascination by this little, I'll call it a dusty corner, but it's not really, a little area of science or the periodic table. And there are others that have got the device concept.
Right.
And you work with the Bell Labs. I mean, so you understand the applicability of chemistry and materials to materials that can do something, as you said earlier on. And so you're all switching gears and looking at this new inorganic paradigm, is what you're saying.
Right. And to see if we can make a contribution there also, since we know a lot about photovoltaics and so on.
Fred Rudel, professor of material science, University of California at Santa Barbara, thank you so much for being here with us.
Well, thank you very much.
It's been
much.
Delightful.
Thank you.
And we thank Norma Martinez, as usual, for putting the program together, and we thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. A nursing professor at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces will launch a new research project in Anthony, New Mexico. The project will mobilize the small community into driving its own healthcare systems, education, and policymaking with the underpinning focus on healthy eating and physical activity. This patient-driven project runs through October 14th. Read more at the region's Life Sciences News Digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.